Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Doctor, lawyer, idiot, chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow beer and fearless eyes. You simper all the times I've tried.
Welcome to Court Appointed. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
How you doing today, Tommy?
Well, not doing too bad. Everything's a little bit hectic around the Smurl house right now, though.
Why is that?
Well, we're getting ready for our show to go up. We've got just over a week to opening and getting all the final touches on the set and getting the lights put up and the sound and running all the final checks. And, you know, it's just getting nerve-wracking, getting everything coordinated, ready to go.
Now, what show are you doing?
Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, it's a good show.
We're doing it at the outdoor amphitheater. It holds about 2,000 people, and we're hoping to fill it up every night. Running it for 3 weekends this summer, starting on June 16th.
It's pretty exciting. I know you guys put a lot of work into that. Every night is just, you know, you're there at the park, practicing, getting ready, and it's hard to find time to squeeze in our podcast here.
I know. I have to be late for rehearsal to get this in time. That's all we do. I mean, we started this. We actually started working on the shows and the production team back in August. We did we did auditions in January, cast the show the 1st of February, and started rehearsals in March. And here we are, almost to the middle of June, to get the show up and running.
You're like a triple threat. You run a business, you have a podcast, and you also do outdoor theater.
I do many things very mediocrely. I'm not great at any of them. That's the way it was in sports in high school. I played all the sports, and I was a starter, but I was like the fifth man on the basketball team, and I wasn't ever a star. I was just always in there. I was in the mix.
The fifth man on a basketball team is still a starter there, right?
Yeah, I was a starter, but I wasn't one of the stars. Never a star. I'm just a role. I'm a role guy. If I were an actor, I'd be a character actor. I wouldn't be a leading man.
Tommy just pawn in Game of Life.
That's right. Just like Mongo. You like those Blazing Saddle references, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Blazing Saddles is a great movie. Love that movie.
Can't get enough Blazing Saddles.
It applies to a lot of things in life. Well, for today's episode, I thought we would bounce back into something we kind of talked about a little bit a couple weeks ago. I just can't get enough of it. Contracts.
Contracts?
Yeah.
Again?
Contract law is actually really interesting, and I think it's kind of funny, too.
Well, I do know that as we went into it, we were talking about like one aspect, and there were so many other aspects that were involved that we didn't even talk about, so.
And it's funny because in law school, contracts class is the one you take your first and second semester of law school, and it's really like the one of the classic law school classes you have where, you know, you're tortured, and it's really hard on law students. And I was not a very good law student. So contracts class was very hard for me and difficult, and it made my brain hurt a lot.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
But you know
what our nickname for you when you were younger was, don't
what's
you?
What's that?
C-boy.
C-boy?
Yeah.
C equals counselor.
C equals passing grade.
But as I came to practice more, and especially my private practice, contract law, even though it was hard for me to go through law school doing
law school's hard.
Law school's hard. It was hard for me to go through contracts class. The lessons I learned must have stuck with me because I remember them and remember them pretty well. So,
well, you know, I believe something
for struggling through life and coming out on the other end.
Well, you remember the important things. You see, you're one of those kind of guys that always lands on your feet, though. Whatever you do always seems to work out.
Well, thanks.
It's like it's a story I read. I read a biography about John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was studying for his final exam, I guess it was at West Point where he went, I think. And he was studying for his final exam. And on part of the exam, they had to be ready to draw like these detailed maps of any state of the states of the United States to pass this test. And he'd put off studying for it. So anyway, it got down to where it was the night before the test, and he had not studied this. So he had all the maps, all 50 maps, in a container. He reached in and pulled out one map and decided, I'm just going to study the hell out of this one. I'm going to know everything on this one and hope it winds up on the test. And it was Rhode Island, if I remember right, the one that he picked. Sure enough, the state they gave him on the test, he had a 1 in 50 chance, was Rhode Island. And he had the top grade in the class.
That's amazing.
It's a guy that always lands on his feet. That's the way you are.
That's well, I don't know about that. But
like the Seinfeld episode where he always breaks even. And to prove it, he threw $20 out the window, and he was getting ready to go run an errand. He got his jacket off the coat rack and put it on, reached in the pocket, says, "Hey, look, $20. There I am. I broke even.
I found some money this weekend.
There you go.
Yeah, I went camping this weekend with my girlfriend. And went up to the mountains, and we were driving along and stopped at a scenic place along the side of the road and just stopped to look. And it was a beautiful view. And she looks down. She's like, "Hey, there's a $5 bill right here." And it was, sure enough, there's a $5 bill folder right there. And I said, "Oh, that's pretty crazy." I took two steps forward. I looked down. I was like, "Hey, here's another $5 bill."
It was bears. They were leaving a trail for you to follow to come into the woods so they could eat you.
Well, that's what I said. If there's another one and we keep walking a little bit farther and farther, it's like somebody's going to pull us back into the woods or something.
You're probably under a federal investigation. It was probably drug money, and now you're linked to it somehow.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. But back to the whole episode and the law stuff. It's going to be on contracts. Essentially, to form a contract, you need three basic things. These are like the three basic ingredients you have to have. And this was at common law.
A pen, a paper, and a stamper thing that stamps it and says it's official.
You forgot wax.
Oh, wax?
No. The
I thought it was the 70s.
The essential three elements of a contract are offer, acceptance, and consideration. And so not all agreements are necessarily like contractual, but they have to have those three things in order to be like legally binding. So when I say offer, and that's basically means that it's an offer to do something, and then you have to accept it by, you know, some sort of assent saying you're going to accept that, and there has to be consideration. And consideration basically means it can be something which is bartered for or goes back and forth. So
doesn't just mean a kindly, gentle spirit.
Exactly.
Not that kind of consideration.
The classic legal thing is that a peppercorn is a good metaphor for nominal consideration.
What?
Like a peppercorn? Like
a peppercorn?
Yeah, like a little piece of pepper, like the spice.
Yeah, what does that have to do with it?
Well, because it's super small, and basically you could use a peppercorn for consideration. So I would say, I will pay you to cut my grass in exchange for a peppercorn. And you could say, yes. And then you'd cut my grass and I'd give you a peppercorn.
I'd say, kiss my butt is what I'd say. Well, I don't want your damn peppercorn.
But that'd be a contract because I offered for you to cut my grass. You accepted.
And I refused.
And I paid you a peppercorn.
I refused.
You took the peppercorn.
I did not take the peppercorn.
But the reason is you have to have these three things, and that's why a lot of times when you see a contract, it'll say something for like in and for exchange of $10, the exchange of which is hereby noted. You might see that like in a contract. Nobody gives somebody $10, but it says that in the contract. And basically that is just so that there is consideration in the contract. It's kind of one of the holdover things, even though it's usually never exchanged. So,
Well, all right. I ran into one of those things with the DMV, so that can get tricky too.
What do you mean?
Well, the DMV, if you're like, say a relative gives you a car,
right?
They can, like your father can give to a son the gift of a car,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to pay taxes on it.
Right.
And if you mark it when you fill out the paperwork and show it as a gift, you're okay. In the state of West Virginia, I imagine this varies from state to state.
Mm-hmm.
But if your father, thinking that he is, you know, covering his bases, puts down in consideration for $1, well, what happens then is the state doesn't recognize it as a gift.
Yeah.
They recognize it as basically an unfair contract. So at that point, you then have to have a signed affidavit saying from the father to the from saying that he actually received the dollar and that was the fair consideration for it.
Really?
Yes.
That's strange. Because a lot of times when you have those contracts, you put some language in there. It'll say something for the sum of $1 of which it is acknowledged herein that it was received. So usually you put that in there.
But you can't do it because it's on the title.
Oh.
And you're just filling in the slots on the title, and the title doesn't have that in
there.
Oh,
okay.
So then you have to go get an affidavit that's notarized, no less, to say, yes, I received my dollar.
That's funny.
Otherwise, they charge you taxes on it, and the minimum is based on $500.
Right.
Whether the vehicle's worth that or not.
Yeah, that's the least it can be.
Yeah.
Hmm. That's pretty funny.
I know.
I guess you kind of outsmart yourself if you do that, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but anything you do, I mean, any kind of contract, I always put in there some sort of nominal consideration like that, just because it's kind of what I've always done and how it's usually supposed to be done. So,
well, when you're selling a car or you're gifting something in the state of West Virginia, you might want to reconsider that.
Well, when you study these essential elements of a contract, a lot of times the cases you study are kind of very strange cases because they tend to illustrate the different elements very well. Kind of like, you know, that one case we talked about last time in the contracts, like the peerless ships. Two ships named Peerless. Obviously, we're not peerless.
Or Lodowick.
Or Lodowick,
that was one of your classic ones.
Yeah. So
I say there, that's my fox you're chasing.
So whenever you look at these kind of elements, you come back to these weird cases. And this is no different. So the first one involves like a charity golf event. So I'm sure you've probably played in a charity golf event, haven't you?
I've played in a few.
Like a scramble?
Yep. That's the only kind I play in because I can't chase my ball all over the place. I'll hit a good one out of about every four. So,
well, have you ever seen like any kind of advertisements on like a par three, like hit a hole in one, you win a car?
Absolutely.
Like mm-hmm. They usually have those, don't they?
And they usually have something there that says no mulligans on this hole. Because a lot of times at these things, you can buy mulligans or whatever.
Yeah.
And mulligans don't count. It's your first shot.
Well, the first case deals with a charity golf event like that and a hole-in-one and winning a car.
I always heard there's insurance policies that they have on that when they do those things.
That would probably be the prudent way to do it, because what happens if like three or four people come out there and hit a hole-in-one?
Yeah, that's right. Unless there's language in there that says the first one or something like
right.
that.
Right. It's only good for the first one. But before we get to that case, I think there might be a motion pending.
Would it please the court if I could approach the bench to pay court costs?
We'll approach the bench. Let's pay some court costs.
Well, on the docket today, we have a new client. We have ZipRecruiter. Now, I can tell you this. As a business manager, business owner, one of the hardest things in my job is finding the right people to fill the jobs. Because there's a lot of people looking for a job, but they're not always the most qualified people.
Yeah, and there's nothing worse than trying to sort through and find somebody to fill the positions when you need it. It's really frustrating.
And that's where ZipRecruiter comes in. If you're hiring, ZipRecruiter has a plan for you. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else.
And here's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours.
24 hours! So not only do you post the jobs you have, but if you are seeking a job, that's the place to post your resume.
Absolutely.
No juggling emails or calls to your office, simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place, with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
So here's your chance to find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results.
And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, I said for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/law.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/law. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/law. You can't beat free.
That's true. Now, we have another client that is would like to approach the bench, and they're our old buddies from DollarShaveClub.com.
So if you've listened to our podcast before, you've heard Tommy and I talk about Dollar Shave Club because we both love it. The razors you get from there are great. The products are great. And right now, you really need to step up your game and get the game-changing shave from Dollar Shave Club.
They have helped me look and feel my best without paying an arm and a leg. And they can do the same for you if you join the club with me.
I can tell you what, you don't have a beard and you're looking pretty smooth over there.
Hey, I'm really putting that razor to good use. It's doing a great job, and I've re-upped for the other cartridges. I keep them coming.
Well, Dollar Shave Club delivers you an amazing smooth shave. You get high-quality blades and amazing shave butter delivered right to your door for an incredible.
It's an incredible smooth shave.
That's like incredible, but even more.
That's right. It's a super incredible. It's incredible. So upgrade both your shave and your bathroom with DollarShaveClub.com. Now, they make your life easier so you don't have to go to the store and get lost in a wall of razors that are either cheap and flimsy or expensive and full of gimmicky tech you don't need.
And with Father's Day right around the corner, what better gift is there than to give a membership to DollarShaveClub.com?
It beats a tie any day.
Absolutely.
So for a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver Shave Butter, which is excellent, for only $5 with free shipping. After that, your razors are just a few bucks a month.
That's a $15 value for only $5. In your first month's box, you get a weighty handle, a full cassette of four Executive cartridges, and a tube of shave butter.
You can only get this offer now by going to DollarShaveClub.com/court.
That's DollarShaveClub.com/court. Do something special for dear old dad this Father's Day.
Yeah, tell him Mike and Tommy suggested it.
So now this case I was telling you about whenever it was during the charity golf tournament, and the name of the case is Cobol v. Click Lewis, Inc. Cobol, he was playing in a golf tournament, and when he got to the ninth hole, there was a car and a sign claiming that the first person to get a hole-in-one wins the car. And it was provided by Click Lewis. And Click Lewis is a car dealership in Palmyra, Pennsylvania. I looked them up online. They're still there. Sure enough, Cobol teed it up and got a hole-in-one, and then he tried to collect on his car. They did not give him, they said, no, we're not going to give you the car. And he sued them for specific performance, basically saying he sued them to deliver the car because he said, you know, hey, I hit the hole-in-one. And now what had happened is that Click Lewis had actually offered the car for a different charity tournament that took place a few days before, but they hadn't taken down the sign or moved the car back before Cobol had played. So basically their whole thing was is like, well, that wasn't open to him. It was for the other tournament, not this tournament. So no dice or whatever. So,
but here's everybody still seeing it and assuming it is. And did they not change the signage in any way? Cause it was probably a different name of a tournament or something like that.
I guess not. It was just out there. Just, you know, said hit a hole in one.
But the sign's there, the car's there, yeah, and everything else. So there's no reason for the standard person that goes by there not to think
right
that that applies to this tournament they're playing.
And so he sued them. The trial court found in his favor. They appealed it. The appellate court affirmed it. And they basically found that it was the manifested intent of the offerer, not the subjective intent, which determines if persons have the power to accept the offer. So basically, in this situation, you have the offer, which was a sign which said hit a hole in one, win a car. And by walking up to the tee box and saying, I accept your offer, I'm going to try to hit a hole in one, he accepted it and hit a hole in one. They found that the hole in one was actually the consideration. Essentially, too, they found that Click Lewis basically benefited from having that sign out there in the car for, you know, advertising purposes, too.
Well, sure. And he may have even been thinking that. Hey, look, we'll just leave that up over there, and everybody will think we did that again. If anybody happens to hit it, we won't give it to them because that was just a mistake.
Yeah.
So they could have actually done it knowingly. Who knows?
Now, the one lone dissent basically said that since making a hole-in-one was kind of like luck, not skill, that the contract should be considered gambling and therefore illegal and enforceable. But that was the dissent, and they didn't believe that.
Well, here's what my opinion is, though, being a hacker golfer of my own, is I still don't think that there was any consideration because every time you walk up to the ball and hit it, you're hoping for a hole in one. So there's no consideration just because you're in a car. You want one anyway. If there's nothing at stake, if it's a beer, you'll do it. It doesn't matter. You just want that hole in one.
Yeah.
So the consideration isn't because of the car. So I would have to dissent on that ground.
Right. And, you know, I mean, these cases are a bit absurd, but like I said, they are used to kind of demonstrate the different principles of the law. So the important thing there is, you know, there was an offer, the sign, acceptance, and then consideration. So that's why they teach that in law school. And that's why, you know, it's kind of interesting. Now, I came across this other case when I was looking at this, and I had never heard of this case before, but it's pretty interesting. And it was in 1865, and it was after...
1865?
Yeah, and it was after President Lincoln was killed, and it was the case of Shoei v. United States. And so basically, after President Lincoln was assassinated, the Secretary of State put an ad in the paper for a $25,000 reward for the capture of one of John Wilkes Booth's accomplices, this guy named John Surratt. So months later, they revoked the offer via ad in the same newspaper. So they revoked it. There was this guy who was named St. Marie who had read the ad, the first ad. He moved to Rome and found out that Surratt, who was the guy they were looking for, he was working for the Pope. He was a papal guard, and he had never seen the revocation. And so basically, he turned him in, and then he sued the United States to get the $25,000 reward for capturing this guy. And he lost. Because they had actually revoked it. So it shows to demonstrate that, you know, there was an offer, but they revoked it. So.
Just because he didn't know it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, they the same way they publicized the reward, they publicized the revocation of the reward. So, I mean, you can't expect everybody to have seen it again, huh?
Yeah. So basically they did it in the same manner. And that's another thing that I think that if you have a situation like this where you've made some sort of offer like this and you want to revoke it, just do it in the same manner that you made that ridiculous offer to begin with. So,
yeah. So like if it was like current times and you had it every news outlet reporting this reward, and then you decide you're going to revoke it and you just put it in like the monthly shopper's guide in some Des Moines, Iowa, that doesn't equate to the same thing. So then you would have a reasonable expectation that people would believe it's still available, right?
Probably not, but I mean, at least you still put it out there. It'd be something to argue. Like, oh, we tried to revoke it in the Des Moines Shopper's Guide, but, you know, it's a large publication. Des Moines is a major city. So, yeah, but that thing with him was pretty interesting, and
Never heard that before.
Yeah, I think there was a movie made about it,
too. I really didn't even know he had accomplices. I thought he did it on his own.
Well, and that's a little bit disputed, whether or not he was an actual accomplice or not. I think he had some sort of plan where he wanted to kidnap Lincoln, and he basically said he had nothing to do with the assassination, but at that point they were probably looking for anybody that might have anything to do with stuff like this. So I think that's why they did that. So.
And I just want to point out that since you revealed my middle name, I am no way related to John Wilkes Booth, so I don't want to get any blowback from that. It's just an old Southern name.
I don't think you're going to have any.
I hope not.
Is Booth an old Southern name?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
That's where it came from. My old Southern grandpa.
Now, here's another case, and this is a classic law school case. It's called Carlyle versus Carbolic Smokeball Company.
What?
Yeah.
Carville versus Carbolic Smokeball Company?
Carlyle. Yeah. 1892 English contract law decision. Essentially, what happened is this company, Carbolic Smokeball Company, they made a product called the Smokeball.
Well, by the name, I would assume that's what they do.
And they claimed it was basically a cure for the flu and some other diseases. Basically, back then, the flu was a pretty big deal, and it was killing a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think it was maybe the Spanish flu was what was going around or something. Anyways, it was a big deal back then.
That was a Spanish fly that was bringing them back.
So basically, what this carbolic smokeball, well, I guess it was just called the Smokeball. What it would do is you would stick this into your nose and squeeze the bottom of it, and it would release vapors. And it was full of carbolic acid or phenol. Mm. And essentially what would happen is it would make your nose run. Thus, basically, you were flushing out any kind of infection that might be in your nose whenever you were doing that.
It sounds like it's probably eroding your brain if you're putting carbolic acid in your body.
Probably. This needs to be a crossover with Sawbones.
Sawbones, yeah. Sydney needs to look into that.
So what they did is they published an advertisement in the Pall Mall Gazette, which is P-A-L-L-M-A-L-L.
Is that like the cigarettes?
I don't think so. And
this is just getting deeper and deeper.
They said they would pay £100 to anyone who got sick with the flu after using their product according to the instructions provided with it. And then the actual advertisement said, £100 reward will be paid. I should let you read this in an English voice. £100 reward will be paid by the Carbolic Smokeball Company to any person who contracts the increasing epidemic influenza colds or any disease caused by taking cold after having used the ball 3 times daily for 2 weeks, according to the printed directions supplied with each ball. £1,000 is deposited with the Alliance Bank, Regent Street, showing our sincerity in the matter. Basically, that's what they're saying. It's like, hey, you know, we put this in there. So
the instructions read simply, hold the ball, squeeze the ball, feel the ball, and smell the ball. You will feel better after this attempt with the ball.
Somebody will feel better after that attempt.
Our balls make you happy.
So our protagonist in this situation was Mrs. Louisa Elizabeth Carlyle. And she saw the advertisement.
I'm going to complain about the balls. They're not helping me. I don't know if I'm using them in the right manner, though.
I squeezed the ball. It made me... I smelled the ball. So she saw the ad, and she bought one of the balls, and she used it 3 times daily.
You need two.
Well, she used it 3 times daily for nearly 2 months, and then eventually she got the flu on January 17th, 1892. And she claimed she wanted £100 from the Carbolic Smokeball Company. They ignored 2 letters from her husband, who was a solicitor, a lawyer.
Oh.
Yeah. So on the third request, they replied with an anonymous letter to her that if it is used properly, the company had complete confidence in the smokeball's efficacy. But to protect themselves against all fraudulent claims, they would need her to come to their office to use the ball each day and be checked by their secretary. So basically they're saying, here's some other things you got to do.
You've got to come here and play with your balls in front of our secretary.
So she just decided, I'm going to sue them. So she sued them, and her barristers argued that basically the advertisement and her reliance on it was a contract between the company and her, and they should have to pay her the £100. The company basically said, hey, this wasn't a serious contract. This was just an advertisement, so whatever. The court found that basically there was a valid contract. Court of Appeal, they actually appealed it as well, and the Court of Appeal rejected their arguments and basically said that there was a fully binding contract for £100 with her, and they gave a couple of reasons. They said that the advertisement was not a unilateral offer to all the world, but an offer restricted to those who acted upon the terms contained in the advertisement, that satisfying the conditions for use of the smoke ball constituted acceptance of the offer, and 3, that purchasing or merely using the smoke ball constituted good consideration, because it was a distinct detriment incurred at the behest of the company, and, furthermore, people buying smoke balls by relying on advertisement was a clear benefit to Carbolic, and that the company's claim that they had put £1,000 into the bank showed that they were serious and intended to be legally bound.
Well, I would agree with all that. The only thing that I would say they had any kind of leg to stand on, first of all, is probably hocus pocus medicine.
I'm guessing so.
but the other part about it is, even if it was a good product, is did she use it right? Because it did say, from what you read in that, it said something about use properly or use following the instructions.
Yeah.
So they don't know. I mean, somehow she would have to demonstrate that she did use it properly for the amount of time suggested.
Well, I mean, that would basically, you could establish that through evidence, through testimony. By asking her.
Well, she should have come in and squeezed her balls in front of the secretary. That's what they asked her to do.
No, that's not what they asked her to do in the ad, though.
No, not in the ad. That was to assure she was doing it right.
That's the difference. The original offer was just to use it properly. The original offer was not to come to our secretary and do
it. Oh, so now they were amending the contract.
Yeah, she had accepted.
So she had no obligation.
She had accepted the previous offer.
Oh, okay.
So there's no need for her to come in and do that again.
Because, oh, all right. Well, I'll agree with that. Still, they need to determine somehow that she did do it right. I mean, what if she was squirting it in her ear or something, you know?
That's obviously not where you squirt a ball.
Or inhaling it in her mouth or something, you know? You never know. Sometimes balls end up in funny places.
I think they probably knew this wasn't going to work anyway, but, you know, I don't know.
I want to find out if carbolic acid really works. Isn't that in car batteries or something?
I don't know. But, yeah, I thought that's a good case to demonstrate it. So one of the funny things about this case and the kind of the what happened afterwards is that the guy who formed the company, he formed a new limited liability company. And
to protect people against such offers.
Yeah. But here, so what he did is he took out another ad. And in this ad, he turned the fact that he had basically lost the case to his advantage. And then basically he described the previous advertisement and said, "Many thousand carbolic smoke balls were sold on these advertisements, but only three people claimed the reward of £100, thus proving conclusively the invaluable remedy will prevent the cure the above-mentioned diseases. The Carbolic Smoke Ball Company now offers a $250 reward to the person who purchases a carbolic smoke ball afterwards and contracts any of the following diseases." But then, in the advertisement, in some small print, were more restrictive conditions that basically said that there were different things you had to appear to. You had to come and essentially demonstrate to the secretary and all this other stuff, which you did before. So basically,
this secretary, she's going to say, "This is not my job. I was not hired. I'm supposed to type letters here. I'm not supposed to sit here and watch people squeeze balls."
But that was a pretty savvy business move there.
Well, it was. I mean, to turn that around and say, we only had three. Everybody had the opportunity. We've sold X number, 100,000 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And only three have complained. That's proof it works.
And to show you even more, we're going to say $250 now.
Yeah.
But here's some other small print.
That is really kind of savvy, but I still think people are rotting their brains away, shooting carbolic acid in their nasal sinuses.
The defense counsel for the Carbolic Smoke Ball Company was H.H. Asquith, who went on to become the Prime Minister of the U.K.
Hmm.
So...
interesting.
Yeah. Mrs. Carlyle, the flu did not kill her, obviously, because she maintained that court action.
True.
And she lived until she was 96 years old. She died on March 10th, 1942. And according to her doctor, she principally died of old age, but there was one other cause, which was flu.
Well, she quit squeezing the balls. If she'd have kept squeezing the balls, she'd have been all right. That was where her problem came in. I think it actually worked because it said she used it for 3 months and was fine. And then suddenly she got the flu. She probably quit using it.
You got to keep squeezing the ball.
That's right. Squeeze the balls daily and you won't get sick.
Another funny case. And this one is called Leonard v. PepsiCo Inc. And this was a 1990 case out of New York, commonly called the Pepsi Points case. There was an advertisement Pepsi put on TV, a commercial, and it essentially showed that there's a couple school children basically sitting around a high school building drinking Pepsi. The boys were going through their Pepsi stuff catalog, which essentially if you drank Pepsi, you got different points, and then you could redeem those points for things in the Pepsi stuff catalog.
Were they like on the bottle caps or something like that?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember what it was. But also you could buy points as well for 10 cents a point.
Hmm.
And also a $10 shipping and handling fee. I guess that was if you saw like a sweet Pepsi jacket that you really wanted to buy.
So instead of buying it with cash, you're actually buying it with points.
Right.
But so, you could buy the points to buy the jacket.
Yeah. Or maybe if you didn't have enough points, but you needed something else, you could do it that way. So basically the commercial shows a Harrier jet coming up, and it said, basically, if you have 7 million Pepsi points, you could win an Harrier II jump jet, which this was, a jet used by the United States military, which was valued at about $33.8 million at the time. And so, sure enough, one smart guy, and I guess there was no way to really get 7 million points at that time, unless you drank a lot of Pepsi.
You'd be dead by then.
So this one guy, John Leonard, what he did is he sent in a certified check for $700,000, which was permitted by the contest rules, and he paid 10 cents a point to get 6,999,985 points and his $10 shipping fee. So basically he had 7 million points because he had a few other Pepsis he had drank too.
Oh, he drank a couple while he was waiting on the points to come back.
So he had the points, and he demanded that...
you get his Harrier jet.
He wanted a Harrier jet. And so... He sued them for breach of contract and fraud. The case was actually brought originally in Florida, but it was heard in New York. It was moved to New York. Pepsi moved for summary judgment. Basically, Leonard, they were going to have a bench trial. Leonard claimed that he wanted to have a jury impaneled, and that he insisted the jury consisted of members of the Pepsi generation. to whom the advertisement would allegedly constitute an offer. That's awesome.
Get the Pepsi generation in there to vote for him. Huh?
Yeah. But anyway, the judge.
Tell me they threw it out.
They threw that one out.
Well, I mean, because there's a certain thing, and I don't remember exactly what it comes under, but if an offer is so absurd, the general public shouldn't really believe it, then it's not legitimate.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, the judge who presided over it, Judge Kimbo Wood, basically said that...
Kimbo Slice?
No, Kimbo Wood. Kimbo Slice, he died.
Well, they could have in 1990. He could have presided.
I don't think he was a doctor of jurisprudence.
You don't think so?
No, he was a doctor of punching.
He said, "You tell the truth or I'll mess you up."
Sounds like Mr. T. Well, he looks like Mr. T a little
he
bit.
He does got
a beard and gold chains.
Yeah.
Basically, the court found that the advertisement featuring the jet was not an offer. Even if the advertisement had been an offer, no reasonable person could have believed that a company would seriously convey a jet worth that, you know, $33 million or $7 million.
It's also government property. I don't think you can sell a government jet.
That was merely puffery.
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 That was a big puffery. It wasn't merely puffery. That was a big puffery.
Yep.
You had to really rear back and take in a lungs full of air to puff that much.
And also, one other thing they talked about was that the value of the alleged contract meant that it fell under the provisions of the statute of frauds. And basically, the state had a statute which required written agreements between the parties when you have something of that value. But the judge wrote that was evidently done in jest. And some other little tidbits from the opinion were, the callow youth featured in the commercial is highly improbable pilot, one who could barely be trusted with the keys to his parents' car, much less the prized aircraft of the United States Marine Corps. The teenager's comment that flying a Harrier jet to school sure beats the bus evinces a improbability insouciant attitude. I don't know how you say that word, toward the relative difficulty and danger of piloting a fighter plane in a residential area. No school would provide a landing space for a student's fighter jet.
So we gotta argue how real this could be?
Or condone the disruption of the jet's use would cause. So,
not to mention, where do you drop the bombs?
Yeah. The court also said that, in light of the Harrier jet's well-documented function in attacking and destroying surface and air targets, armed reconnaissance and air interdiction, and offensive and defensive anti-aircraft warfare,
we do not want Pepsi giving them to the general public.
Depiction of such a jet as a way to get to school in the morning is clearly not serious, even if, as plaintiff contends, the jet is capable of being acquired in the form that eliminates its potential for military use.
Well, I'm glad they saw it that way. If you were to tell me that they had to give him the jet, I was going to be disappointed.
He appealed it. He said, "Oh, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and appeal this." And
the Supreme Court surely wouldn't listen to that case.
Well, it didn't go to the Supreme Court. It went to the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. That's the intermediate appellate court. And they gave a per curiam opinion, basically said, we affirm for substantially the reasons stated in Judge Wood's opinion. They didn't have as much fun with it as Judge Wood did.
I'm glad it didn't go to the Ninth Circuit. Those guys, there's no telling what they'd have done.
Who knows? So basically, Pepsi continued to air the commercial, but they updated the cost of the Harrier jet to 700 million Pepsi points.
Now, I do have to say that in all fairness, they should have given him his money back because those points didn't cost them anything.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
So they should have said, look, we realize what you're trying to do, and we're going to be nice public citizens. We're going to give you your money back.
Well, I don't know that they ever actually sent him the points. I think he just sent in a certified check basically saying it was there. You know, I don't know if they ever even cashed it.
Well, that's what I mean.
They probably thought something was amiss whenever they got a check for that much. They're like, wait, we're going to need to get a manager in on this one. it's a little weird.
Some bean counter putting the checks in there. What is this? Hey, I need a manager. I need an adult. I need an adult.
He's not buying a jacket here. The White House released a comment on this, basically said that they would not sell to civilians without demilitarization of a Harrier jet, which in the case of the Harrier would have included stripping it of its ability to take off and land vertically.
So basically, it would have just been a neat tree fort.
I guess so. But that's the Leonard v. PepsiCo case. So whenever I was looking at this PepsiCo case, it made me think of that movie Real Geniuses. You remember that movie?
I remember the name. I don't remember what it was about.
Well, it had Val Kilmer in it, where they were basically these engineering students at this like really smart school. And one high school student goes there. I think he's only 16. But he meets all these like really super smart people, and they do all these like really pranky, fun stuff Anyway, like they fill their dormitory hall with like ice and turn into an ice skating rink.
That's not the one where they built a woman, was it? No, yeah. That was science. Something science or something, wasn't it?
Weird Science.
Weird Science, yeah. Yeah,
no, not that one. Kind of okay. The same genre a little bit.
Yeah.
But no, Real Genius is a great movie, and it was one of the first movies that, and only movies we had on videotape, VHS, so I watched it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But one of the characters in it was called Laszlo, and he was this older student who got burned out and basically lived in the walls of their dormitory. And when you first meet Laszlo in the movie, he's basically has a computer writing up all these entries to enter a Frito-Lay contest, which said you could enter as much as you want. And he was going to enter 1,650,000 entries, which he basically said should make him win 31.8% of the prizes according to his calculations. And so that was like one of the underlying subplots of the movie. And at the very end, you see him like driving off with his new
Frito-Lay mobile,
his new wife and an RV with all the things. And he says something like, well, I won 30%. I'm not sure about the numbers. I'll have to crunch those later, but we'll see. So that always reminded me of that. But actually that was based on a real event that took place with Caltech students. And there was a McDonald's sweepstakes. They used it and they won 20% of the prizes, including a car. And that was something that happened back in the 80s at Caltech.
Hey, so. Well, if you can enter all you want, then, you know, no purchase necessary.
Yeah. So
you can do it.
Yeah, but that was kind of interesting, I thought so.
Well, I had one that I found that brings us back to the golf game.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard of this case or not. It was Grove v. Carboneau Buick Pontiac.
I have not.
It's sort of the same thing. It has to do with a hole-in-one contest, but here's where it got muddy. The Dickinson Elks Club conducted its annual Labor Day golf tournament on September 1st and 2nd, 1974. Posters were placed at various locations in the area announcing the tournament and the prizes to be awarded to the flight winners and runners-up. Included in the posters was an offer by Carboneau of a 1974 automobile to the first entry, this is a quotations, to the first entry who shoots a hole-in-one on hole number 8. This offer was also placed on a sign and the automobile at the tournament. Well, here's where it starts getting sketchy. This was a 9-hole golf course that played as 18 because it had two sets of tee boxes for each hole.
Oh,
so
okay.
You played like the red tees the first time around and the blue tees the second time around.
Right, yeah.
So the guy, this Grove, that's the Grove V, he was playing in the golf tournament. He came around on hole number 17, which was, in essence, hole number 8, and hit a hole in one and claimed the car. Well, of course, Carboneau Buick, they say, well, no, you weren't on hole number 8, you were on hole number 17. And the guy basically said, what does the flag say? Well, the flag says 8 because there aren't two different greens, it's one green, you play for two different tee boxes. What does the flag say? Well, it says hole number 8. I made a hole in one on hole number 8, but no, you were playing hole 17.
Yeah.
So, as with these things, this went to the lower court, and the lower court ruled in his favor and said, you got to give him the car.
Yeah.
And so then that went to the North Dakota Supreme Court to decide this. So, and they said that the hole was more difficult. It was actually 60 yards further from the 17th tee box than it was from the 8th tee box.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things that helped decide it because he had gained no advantage in it. But it said that the rewards and prizes are governed by the general rules of contract. There must be a genuine offer and an acceptance. To collect a prize, one person must perform all of the requirements. So he says he did that. It said the offeror has the right to prescribe in his offer any condition as to meet, place, quantity, mode of acceptance, or other matters. And what they're saying is they put nothing in there. They wrote up the contract, that Carboneau Buick. They wrote up the contract in the advertisement. They didn't say only if you're playing it as hole number 8. They didn't say if there's a dispute, here is who will decide. All that was at theirs. And what they said was, if the contract basically is left kind of with ambiguity, that whoever wrote it is judged harsher.
Yeah, well, that's a tenet of contract law. Any ambiguity goes against the person who construed it, who wrote it. So,
But I thought it was funny, they get down, and so the Supreme Court for North Dakota there, they go through their reasoning with it. They said, none of the words used in the offer stand out as being technical words. The argument was made by Carboneau that the offer provided for a hole-in-one on hole number 8, not in hole number 8, the right. key word being on or in.
Yeah.
So they're saying that that made them free because of on. So the Supreme Court, they go and they start looking in golf magazine, specifically Golf Digest, to look to see how things are described. Well, the first thing it is, look at the PGA rulebook. PGA rulebook had nothing determining what hole, how they were counted if you're in a 9-hole course. Everything pertains to 18 holes and doesn't prescribe that.
Right.
So they couldn't find anything there. So then they go to Golf Digest, and they look through all the holes in one that were mentioned and how they were worded. But then one they found, it caught their eye in particular. And it said, in the same article, the following interesting description of consecutive holes in one, apparently on a 9-hole course converted and used as an 18-hole course, was found. And this is in parentheses. Finished an 18-hole round on the 9-hole golf club course in Frampton, Quebec, August 24th, by holing tee shots on the 220-yard 8th and the 155-yard 9th, the 17th and 18th holes of the day. So even though they're saying the golfer was playing them as the 17th and 18th, they're calling his holes in one as being on the 8th and 9th. So they found that as backing up the fact what this guy was saying. And there again, it came into that about there was no advantage because it was actually further away, so it made it more difficult.
Right.
So he ended up having to give him the car.
That's a weird case.
I know. I thought that was a good one, too, that went along with your one that you had, but it was funny. They even got him on the stand and they were trying to question him about it. And they said, so where did he, you know, where did he hit the ball? Well, he hit it in the 8th hole. How did you know it was 8th hole? Well, the flag said it was number 8. Well, so then he made a hole in one number 8. No, because he was playing number 17. What did the flag say? So the guy said that he has to admit, well, it says 8. So, you know, they got this guy. So even his own testimony, he was kind of screwing himself on his own testimony because he had nothing else he could do.
Touching on that ambiguity thing you had mentioned, that's why if you see in a contract that it says something that a contract was drafted by the parties jointly, that's why you have a clause like that in there, because they were trying to avoid having any ambiguity construed against them. So sometimes you'll see that clause in there too.
And that, you know, it even went a step further on it besides the ambiguity from that. You know how a lot of times in scrambles, not everybody starts on number one and works their way. Everybody goes starts on another hole.
Right.
So they threw in there further, who's to say what hole number 8 was? If you started on the 4th tee, is hole number 8 hole number 8, or is it the 8th hole you play? So they were saying basically every hole could have been considered by everybody there as the 8th hole, because at some point you're playing that as the 8th hole, and everybody had two chances at it because they were playing those same holes over and over. So,
man, I'd hate to be the attorney that drafted that.
I know.
That up.
So they went through, they listed all these sequences. It could have been this, and there's like four lines of sequences that the numbers possibly could have been construed, so that it all came back to, look, you screwed up when you wrote that. You should have done better.
People wonder why lawyers are so literal and anal about like things like that.
Yeah. when you see this, you see why.
Oh, that's probably why.
But I'm thinking, you know, this guy, when I'm first reading this, I'm thinking, you know, this guy Grove that made the issue, that was a dick move.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're playing 17. What did you put on your card? Did you put it on hole number 8 or did you put it on 17?
Right.
You put your score down as 17, right? But then you're going to pull this move and say, oh, yeah, I made a hole-in-one on hole number 8. See what the flag says?
Yeah.
And that's what you're basing it on. That's a dick move.
Well, back in 1970, you know, what kind of car was it?
It didn't say. It just said a 1974 car.
Oh.
Okay. It was worth like $5,800. You could buy a new car in 1974 and then a luxury one. This was a Buick or a Pontiac for $5,800.
It might be worth litigating that. I don't know. So some states actually have like lots of laws on the books and things. And one state in particular is Florida. And under 849.0935, they actually, which 849 is the gambling section, but they have all these requirements. So basically if you were going to have a drawing by chance or anything like that, so any...
Bingo?
Yeah. And like all brochures, advertisement, notices, tickets, entries, blanks used in connection with the drawing shall conspicuously disclose the rules governing the conduct and the operation of the drawing, the full name of the organization and its principal place of business, the source of the funds used to award cash prizes or purchase prizes, the date, hour, and place where the winner will be chosen and the prizes will be awarded unless the brochures, advertisement, notices, tickets, or entry blanks are not offered to the public more than 3 days prior to the drawing, that no purchase or contribution is necessary. So basically, like, Florida's gone even a step further and said, if you're going to put out like different things like this, you're going to have to put more stuff in your advertisement. You just can't throw it out there.
You can't, because otherwise you're kind of making it up as you go.
Yeah, yeah, because they want to hold people accountable, because otherwise, yeah, you could make stuff up.
Well, that's so. Like several years back, they cracked down on the Catholics in their bingo running games.
Yeah.
They would have these bingo games, and they finally said, hey, look, this is gambling. You've got to comply with certain rules for this to work. You can't just run this thing willy-nilly. And I can say that since I'm Catholic, but yeah. All the Catholics got cracked down on for their bingo parlor games.
Well, they
the nuns were running them in the back rooms. The
nuns are cracking knuckles with their rulers.
That's right. You did not get a bingo. Crack! Back to your chair. You start over. It reminds me of that buddy of mine from college, Callaghan, mm-hmm. that I've talked about before. He went to a Catholic school. He said that the nuns would crack them on top of the head with a big, heavy-duty Bible when they'd get out of line. They'd crunch them right on top of the head with this Bible.
Wow.
And said when they were supposed to come in from recess that the nuns would come out, and I don't know, they'd do something, ring a bell or yell freeze or something like that, and all the kids were just supposed to stand motionless while they made any kind of announcements or whatever before they went single file back in the building. Said one day they came out and they announced to them, stand motionless. So all the kids were standing motionless. And all of a sudden this one kid that was evidently kind of rebellious, all of a sudden he just broke out of the line and started running around going, I refuse, I refuse. And said, here was a nun running after him with this big Bible trying to hit him on the head. And he's running around the playground trying to get away from her, yelling, I refuse.
It's crazy.
He's from New Jersey. Everybody from New Jersey is crazy.
I went to Catholic school too, and we didn't have any kind of corporal punishment when I went there. That had kind of already gone away, I guess. As far as I remember anybody getting spanked or.
Well, that one, was it the principal that was there? That was really tough.
Sister Carmela?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She would have liked to administer corporal punishment if they'd have let her.
Yeah, she was scary.
Yeah.
She was a good teacher, though. I had her.
She's like one of those nuns that you see going down the hall and their legs aren't moving. They just glide. She was like that. I was an adult and I was scared of her.
The one funny story is, I think it was Sister Mary Michael.
Sister Mary Elephant?
Sister Mary Michael. She locked Bill, my law partner, because we went to elementary school together, Our Lady Fatima together. He was a year or two older than me. Anyway, he got in trouble. She locked him in a closet. And that was it was a big deal. I remember
it was a penance closet.
Yeah, Sister Mary Michael locked Bill in a closet. So
you could do that in those days.
Yeah.
It was okay.
It caused
Nowadays, they charge you with kidnapping and throw you in the pen.
Yeah.
You can't do that. I don't know. They don't let you abuse your kids nowadays. It's just against the law.
Back in my day, you could beat your kid.
That's right. That's why we turned out so good. Spare the closet and spoil the child.
I don't think that's how that one goes. But... Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over some different legal terms that we talked about during the course of the show. Usually it's me asking Tommy about some of the terms, see if he remembers exactly what they mean, or sometimes Tommy springs one on me. So today...
Like Nemo Tenter.
Yeah, Nemo Tenter, which I can't remember what that means. Nemo Tenter. What does it mean? I can't remember.
It was the main thrust of what our topic was last week.
What was our topic last week?
I don't know. I was hoping you'd remember by that clue. Let's see. I'd have to think of what the title was.
That was the
Star Chamber.
Star Chamber.
Oh, as it has to do with not having to testify against yourself.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's the lawyer phrasing of that, of those words, how you don't have to accuse yourself or whatever.
Bear witness against your own name.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now I remember, yeah.
Boy, I can't remember from week to week what's going on. I got too much to do here.
So the first term...
I got an excuse. I'm old and overwhelmed.
I'm just overwhelmed. So the first term for Legal Briefs this week is offer.
Offer?
Offer.
Well, an offer is like in the example of the golfing thing, the offer was the contest. That's showing that if you hit the hole in one, that you win the car. So they made the offer that if you fulfill their what they're asking you to do, that you get the prize.
And after an offer, what do you have to have?
You have to have acceptance.
That's right.
And you accept it by doing whatever the offer says.
And then what is the one thing you have to have as well to have a valid contract?
You have to be kind and gentle and considerate.
Consideration. It's consideration, but it's far from being kind and gentle. Yes, consideration. And what was the one classic example that I said is, can be used as consideration to demonstrate it can be nominal?
The $1 for doing something?
Yeah, that was one thing, but there was another thing that's you were like, what?
Was this a smoke ball?
No, it was a peppercorn.
A peppercorn. Yeah, that's right.
And that's basically the classic thing you use to basically say that you can have any amount of consideration. So if you're going to cut
my grass. Is that old English?
Peppercorn?
Yeah.
No, you can buy peppercorns these days.
Well, I know, but who would even think of using that?
A peppercorn?
Yeah.
I use peppercorns.
Well, what I'm thinking is back in the old days, they might have used those to trade for goods or whatever like that. I will give you 3 peppercorns for a bolt of wool so I can have some underwear.
A bolt of wool.
Knit myself some wool underwear. It's going to be cold, and I've got to keep the carbolic balls warm. Oh, Schmedley.
A bolt of wool. Well, that's actually going to do it for Legal Briefs. That's all.
I'm 100% again.
Yeah, you're 100% with your bolt of wool.
You know about that.
So... yeah, I think the important thing to remember when you have a contract, you know, 3 basic elements we went over, offer, acceptance, consideration, and that's
it. Well, and the other thing that we in the biz say, look at the 4 corners.
That's right.
That's what we in the biz say.
Yeah.
So what's contained within those 4 corners is where your legal stand will come from.
Yes, absolutely. It's in the 4 corners.
Yeah. Don't look around the outside edges there, the outer limits.
Yeah, because we're not going to deal with any parole evidence.
That's right. The Outer Limits is an old TV show, so don't look at that.
Maybe the Twilight Zone, but not the Outer Limits.
That's right.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes. Especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Sprung. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.